Thanks, John. You're too kind. I'm reminded of the man who was introduced as a speaker who had made millions in oil in Texas. And when he got up to speak, he said, "Well, I appreciate that very fine introduction, but I feel like I need to make just a couple of minor corrections." He said, actually, it wasn't Texas, it was Pennsylvania. And he said it wasn't oil, it was coal. And he said it really wasn't millions, it was thousands. And he said, actually, it wasn't me, it was my brother, and he didn't make it, he lost it. So. You know, we have all these young people here helping in this conference, and last night after we were over, you know, I talked about books last night, and we were finished, one of these real pretty young ladies came up to me, and she said, "That was fantastic, what you said about those books. It made me want to buy all of them. It was so fascinating, and it was funny." And she said, "And you're kind of cute, too." And that kind of surprised me, and I said, well, thank you. I said, I don't get a lot of compliments like that. And she said, "Well, I didn't think you would." Well, you know, John is from Oakdale, California, the self-proclaimed cowboy capital of the world, and that gave me a clue for my topic today. I thought it ought to have something to do with guns and cows, and so I'm sticking my neck out with our topic today. And let me remind you that most of the things I'm talking about, you can't really claim for me to be a heretic, so please don't brand me and start the fire yet. My name is David Mays. I'm from Indianapolis. I have one wife, three married children, and eight unmarried grandchildren. And my ministry since about 1985 has been helping church leaders develop their missions ministry and strengthen them. And I try to latch on all the good ideas and resources I can find and make them available to people like yourself. And I have a ministry dream. And my dream is a movement of churches organizing the entire church around the Great Commission. And so if you know of any churches like that, I wish you would let me know what they are. I'm looking for some good models to include. And in fact, I put together a little booklet in the book table called Becoming a World-Changing Church. And that little booklet is sort of my idea of what a church like that would look like and how it would work and what it would take to do it. So it's a very inexpensive little booklet, so you might want to get it and take a look at it. At least I hope you'd like to. Even if you don't, I hope you'd like to. John was talking about the Stuff CD. This is the CD called Stuff You Need to Know About Doing Missions in Your Church. It is an encyclopedia of just about any topic that you're interested in about missions in your church, one page per topic. So every page is simply the bottom line. It's a bullet list, a handout, an outline, the bare facts that you need on any topic. So suppose you want to know something about how should we treat missionaries when they retire? Or how can I find the Lausanne Covenant on world evangelization? Or what are the worst trip mistakes anybody ever made on a missions trip? Or what are 10 key steps I could use to get our congregation to pray for unreached peoples? You got any kind of questions like that, you can probably find it on this CD. And as John says, I printed it all out once and tried to put it in a 3.5-inch ring binder, and I couldn't get volume 5 in. So there's plenty of material, but you don't have to print it all out. You don't have to read it all. You just save this on your computer and look for whatever you need. Print that. It's in Word. You can modify it for your congregation and print out 20 copies and hand them out. So do me a favor. Bibe Ooks. Isn't that what we said? Okay, I work for the Mission Exchange. The Mission Exchange is an association of mission organizations and churches equipping leaders to be more effective in the Great Commission. And for the Mission Exchange, I write book summaries, interview authors, facilitate seminars on the web. We call them webinars, a terrible name, about 24 a year on all aspects of missions. And if you'll go to themissionexchange.org, oh my goodness, there's the website, themissionexchange.org, you can find out about the Mission Exchange. And we do have inexpensive memberships available for churches and individuals that help you tap into these resources very inexpensively. So let me encourage you to do that. All right, here's where you get the rotten tomatoes ready, because I'm going to shoot the first cow. First shot, bang. The heart of the Great Commission is not make disciples. Got awful quiet in here, didn't it? Now, don't hear me say we should not make disciples. In fact, probably the area where we've been really weak, not only in missions, but in our local churches, is teaching them to obey whatsoever I have commanded you. We're really weak in making disciples. We must make disciples. It's important that we make disciples, but it's not the heart of the Great Commission. And here's my issue. Well, let me just read what I have for Matthew 28 and see if this is what you read when you read this passage. Do you read these words? Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. Is that the way you read it? It's the NIV. Most of us reading the NIV. Okay? No problem with that? So there's make disciples. Now, most authors exegete this and say go is really a participle and the main verb is make disciples. So there are many churches, many books on churches about doing church that start out by saying the heart of the Great Commission is make disciples. Here's how it works. The author begins at the beginning of the book. I noticed this probably 10 years ago, reading a book on how to do church. The author starts out, said, the marching orders for the church is the Great Commission. I said, great, we're off on the right foot. I'm entirely with you. Then he says, the heart of the Great Commission is to make disciples. Okay, so what was the book about? The book was all about going out to reach people in your community, bring them into your church, and make disciples out of them. Toward the end of the book, there was about a half page on world missions. I said, well, what happened to the nations? What happened to the nations in the Great Commission? Well, here's what I think happened. Matthew 28:19. Here's the Greek text out of my Greek interlinear New Testament. Some of you can read that. Mathetusate pantata ethne. So, what does it say? Therefore, go, in the NIV, therefore, go and make. Now, we all know from early grammar that a subject has to have, a sentence has to have a subject and a verb to make sense. The subject is the implied you. You go. In the Greek, it's right into the verb itself. You go. You plural. You go. And what's the verb? The verb is make. You go and make. Well, now, make is a transitive verb. Did you want a grammar lesson today? Make is a transitive verb. A transitive verb means it transfers the action to an object. So you don't have a complete thought with a transitive verb unless you have the object. So go, therefore, and make. So what is the object? What is the object? Go ye, therefore, and make. What's the object? Disciples. Okay, all right. So therefore, you go and make disciples. So what are we supposed to do? Got a whole complete thought, right? You go and make disciples. Boom. So you write a whole book. So what happened to the nations? Well, it became a prepositional phrase. Go ye therefore, you want to diagram it? Go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations. Remember those diagrams? Well, that part got lost. The core, according to this book, and many others I've read since. I read this over and over and over and over again, that the heart of the Great Commission is make disciples, and the whole book is about reaching people in your community. Okay? All right, I kind of like the King James Version. Remember, I memorized this years ago in the King James. Go ye therefore and teach. Okay, the word mathetusate is the second person plural command form. And it was translated in the King James as teach. But teach is a little bit weak because mathetes, the noun form, is disciple. So teach is a little bit weak. So the NIV went with disciple because, it's a fuller explanation of the word mathetuo. But the King James says teach, and it has this advantage because teach is a transitive verb. You can't say teach without saying teach somebody or teach something. Just like you can't say, go ye therefore and call. Go and call. Would you go and call? Well, That's not a complete sentence. You have to go call your father or go call the dog or go call somebody or something. So, what is the object? Teach is a transitive verb. So what's the object in the King James? Go ye therefore and teach all nations. So what are we to do? So what's the core? Go is the participle. We are to teach all nations, or we are to disciple all nations. So the heart of the Great Commission is not just make disciples. The heart of the Great Commission is disciple all nations. You can't really have the discipling without the nations. Now, the outworking of this little translation effort here has been that in churches, leaders focus on making disciples and neglect all nations. And this is really pervasive. I'll tell you what, just about 3 years ago, I was preparing a workshop for pastors in a district of my denomination, and I wanted to call it the Great Commission Driven Church. It was all about how to organize your church around the Great Commission. I wanted to call it the Great Commission Driven Church. And one of the pastors emailed me, and he said this. It was almost a quote. He said, "I've been studying the Great Commission Church, and I've been teaching some on it, and he said, I'd like for you to cover something more global." I said, I'm onto something here. I'm onto something. When a pastor is looking for something more global and he thinks the Great Commission is local, we have domesticated the Great Commission. We're losing the nations. So, let me tell you a little story to try to illustrate this. My father-in-law is widowed. And my wife was going to be gone, and she was going to be gone for several days to help him clean up and take care of his place after his wife had died. And so she was going to be gone. She said to me, now, I'm making up this story, but let's assume it's true. I made up the other one, too, but this is her illustration. But suppose she says to me, look, you know, as soon as I get back, your folks are coming, and they're going to be here for a couple of days. And so while I'm gone, I want you to clean up this whole house. He said, you know, I'm not going to be here to do it, and it's going to be a mess if you don't get it done. So I want you to clean every room. So she leaves. Well, I'm busy. I work at home. I have an office in my home. That part's true. And so I'm working away at my home, and I don't spend much time in the rest of the house while she's gone. I found more time to work. But it kind of sticks in my mind. She wants me to clean up around here. And so I keep thinking, she wants me to clean up, you know. And so I'm looking around my office. It's really a mess. And so I'm only in the living room maybe to watch the news and read a couple of magazines, and only in the kitchen maybe to grab a bowl of cereal or a bite to eat. And so I begin to feel convicted about this. So I'm working in my office. I start rearranging papers and making stacks, and I even get the dust mop out, and I dust my office. And I think I've got the place in pretty good shape when she returns. And she comes in, and she looks around, and she said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, I've been cleaning up." She said, "What about the whole house?" You see, there's a big difference between cleaning up and cleaning the whole house. And there's a big difference between making disciples and discipling the nations. So I want to suggest to you that the heart of the Great Commission is not make disciples. It is disciple all nations. Now, that's a big job. That's not a narrow job. It includes both evangelism and discipleship. But I want to suggest that discipling all nations is not one of the programs or ministries of your church. It's the purpose of your church. And there's a huge difference between programs and purposes. Because, you see, programs are optional, they're pragmatic, they come and go, you don't expect everybody to be involved, but purpose belongs to everyone. Purpose belongs to every person, every leader, and every ministry. And if you don't contribute to part of the purpose, you don't really belong to the organization. And that's what discipling the nations is. Okay, did I convert you over to my view on that? That wasn't too hard to sell. Okay, I'm going to get real risky here. You ready for the next one? I'm going to fly in the face of the wave of today, and I'm going to say, poverty, pain, and depression are not God's primary concern. They're not God's primary concern. Now, don't hear me say that God isn't concerned about poverty, pain, oppression, and injustice. He is concerned about it. But I think he's more concerned with something else. Last Sunday, and this is a true story, last Sunday in my weekly email to my friends and supporters, I wrote this question. Are the things on God's mind increasingly become front burner items on my mind? I want them to ask that question too, but I'm asking that question. And one of my friends wrote back this. Yes, the things God thinks about are becoming our foremost thoughts, hunger, poverty, and the downtrodden. I thought, wait a minute, that's not what I thought was the foremost thing on God's mind. There are books being written now that seem to interpret God's primary concern as improving our physical situation. For example, I just read a book, probably the best missions book. I'm going to move this. I keep seeing this bang sign. I don't want to see it anymore. Probably the best missions book that came out last year made a statement like this. It said that God was displeased with Israel and they were exiled because of Israel's failure to care for the poor and the oppressed, and gave two verses. I thought about that. I said, I've just been reading in the Kings and the Prophets, and I don't remember reading that particular emphasis. So I went back and looked through it, and I read that all through the books of the Kings and Prophets, the Israelites were repeatedly warned that their primary sin was the worship of false gods and the breaking of their fellowship with the one true God, which resulted in a whole lot of things, including disobedience, which included not taking care of the poor and oppressed. But I thought this is kind of a one theme that's being introduced as the whole theme. A few years ago, I read a book that said that Jesus' purpose statement is Luke 4, 18 and 19. I'll read it for you. You'll recognize it. He picked up the scroll and he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." You recognize those verses from Luke, right? Powerful verses. And so it's become the theme now of a series of books to say that this was Jesus' purpose statement, and therefore it should be our purpose statement. Well, a couple things. One is, there's some question about exactly what Jesus meant when he said he came to preach and to proclaim those things, and whether his primary object was to speak to the poor or about the poor. But he also said a whole lot of other things about his purpose and about what he wanted his disciples to do. And so the last 3 months or so, I've been combing the Gospels, looking to see what did Jesus do and what did he say, and then I went back to him again and asked, what did Jesus specifically say about his purpose, and what did he specifically ask his disciples to do, and what did the authors of the four Gospels say about that? And it's overwhelmingly true that what Jesus' primary concern about was life, real life, abundant life, spiritual life, eternal life, the Christ life. That's his primary concern. That his creatures that he's created are in relationship with him, that he can love them and they can love him and they can have this life. And that life produces an awful lot of things that help people in their pain and their poverty and oppression. So helping the poor and the sick and the oppressed is something we're supposed to do. We're supposed to love people. Jesus healed people. He loved. He had compassion. That's what we're supposed to do. It's not the primary thing. It may be the primary means in today's world, but the primary thing is that people come to know Jesus and live eternally. Because, you know, this life is temporal. It's going to end. And if we help people out of their pain, but they die without Jesus, we lost the whole thing. Someone had a cartoon in which the first person said, "I don't understand why God allows poverty, pain, and oppression when he could just do something about it." Now the person says, "I'm afraid he's going to ask me the same question." Oh, interesting, right? In an ACMC conference several years ago, Luis Palau was the main speaker, and I'll never forget. He grew up in South America, and he said, "You know, where I grew up, a lot of people came in the early part of the 20th century and did a lot of humanitarian work. But," he said, "only where the church was planted is the humanitarian work still being done." So when people come to Christ, you know, C.S. Lewis says you can't make people good with laws, but you can't have laws and good people without good people. So people's life in Christ is the primary thing. Now, why am I concerned about this? So here's what I think is God's primary concern. His glory among all the nations. The billions who do not have life. The lack of fellowship with His creatures and the huge out-of-reach areas of the world. And life. That these people might have life. I'm concerned about this because I see three streams converging. The convergence of three streams today. First of all, in our culture, there's a tremendous wave of compassion. I talked with Bruce Camp recently. Many of you know Bruce Camp, Evangelical Free Church, Southern California. I said, it seems to me that churches are moving wholeheartedly toward compassion ministries. He said, it's already passed. We're already there. There's a huge wave of compassion in our culture, in our churches, and especially among our young people. That's a wonderful thing, that God would give Americans a great heart of compassion for people. So I think that's a wonderful thing. I applaud that. But I've been seeing this for several years. I was at Taylor University, where I graduated at 65 or 80 years ago, and I spoke with the missions class, and I asked all those students, what do you hope to do when you graduate? And almost all of them, they wanted to work in inner city ministry, they wanted to work in poverty, they wanted to help medically with the poor and oppressed people. The whole class wanted to do that. There's a great wave that way. I was in a mega church in eastern Ohio 2 weeks ago and met with the church and missions leaders there. And I said, what are you finding that really helps people get interested and involved in missions? He said, it's the causes. Everybody's hearing about the needs in the world. And he said, we have Africa AIDS and Bono. And we have all these causes. And people, that appeals to them. And so we're getting people involved in helping. And we're getting in partnerships and involved in doing that. So we see a tremendous move toward compassion ministries. The second stream that I've been seeing come along is a generation of young people coming out of our churches, and many who maybe not have been in our churches very long, who really have a fairly weak understanding and experience of their faith. They have a warm, fuzzy feeling about Jesus, and they kind of love people, but if you wanted them to explain, like to somebody who didn't agree or didn't understand what they believed and what it meant, what some of the key doctrines are, how Christianity is different from other religions, they're really kind of clueless. Many of them haven't read a whole lot, they haven't studied a whole lot, and the internet, they say, is the friend of information, but the enemy of thinking. And so perhaps we don't have a lot of strong, linear thought processes going on, not a lot of reasoning and rationale. And so we have people that really don't understand their faith very well, can't explain it very well, and maybe really aren't too convinced of some of the details of it. And I'm wondering, are we producing a generation of young people who are going to be able to offer spiritual hope to people? Now, whether you agree with that probably depends a whole lot on what person's face pops into your mind. Because when I explained this to a couple I know really very well, but I hadn't seen for a while, they said, oh, I disagree. And they proceeded to tell me about a young woman who had been working in an extremely difficult country in the Middle East, and who had actually had members of her team killed, and insisted that she was going to stay on because Jesus wanted her there, and she had a work to do there. I applaud those people. I want more of those people, as many as possible. But perhaps some face popped into your mind from somebody in your church that you know fairly well, that you feel is, you know, maybe concerned about people, but kind of weak and not really too educationally sound. And maybe that kind of a face pops into your mind. I think we have a lot of these people. Now, the third stream that merges in here that concerns me is some of the ways that our church is adapting to our culture. And one of those ways is picking up the values, including the value of tolerance. Now, we don't really understand in our culture tolerance correctly. Tolerance, properly understood, means I accept you and affirm you even if I disagree with your idea. And so tolerance means we're egalitarian towards persons, but elitist when it comes to ideas. We can scrutinize ideas without denigrating the person. But it's come to mean that we associate the person with the idea. So if we, it is assumed that if you don't like my idea, you don't like me, and therefore you're intolerant. Now, this is in the church just as well as anyplace else. Just ask yourself, how many times do people ask you, have you witnessed to somebody this week? Two generations ago was a common question. Did you witness to anybody this week? You know, it's very uncomfortable to witness. Our culture doesn't like it very well. They don't think it's a very good idea for us to do this, and our young people are growing up in this culture where there's sort of a sense that probably everybody's all right, and it really isn't very nice to tell people they're not all right, so what are we going to do? And here's what Robert Wuthnow said. Robert Wuthnow is the director for the Center of Church Study at Princeton. He wrote a book called Boundless Faith, The Global Involvement of North American Churches. It just came out a few months ago. And here's what he wrote in his book. Quote, the social pressures to emphasize service rather than evangelism are quite powerful. Given the prevailing ethos of tolerance in the United States, it seems quite wrong to confront a devout Muslim or Hindu about his or her need to believe in Jesus, whereas no questions would be raised about giving a starving Muslim or Hindu a meal. Right? Not surprisingly, a popular solution to this dilemma is to redefine service as evangelism. To redefine service. In other words, to do service and call it evangelism. I talked to somebody here at this conference and I said, do you have a missions pastor? And they said, well, really, missions is in the department that's called compassion. See what happens? Evangelism is becoming a subsection of compassion. What we're doing is moving the primary concern for souls to the secondary concern for bodies, and we're reversing that. We're saying we want to go out, our people appeal, that we appeal to our people, we're going to do all this good for people, we're going to help in their physical situation, and we hope that they'll become Christians. Almost like we might say we hope they'll become Republicans. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but depending on where you are, this gradient is farther or not so far along. That's why I'm concerned. That's why I'm concerned. Where are we headed? In the last generation, perhaps, we stress conversion with an inadequate emphasis on obedience, including helping those who need help. But we dare not make the opposite mistake, emphasizing service and neglecting the soul. I want to suggest to you that the service avenues are wonderful avenues which we should take advantage of to help people physically and spiritually. We must be sure to introduce people to Jesus. Well, some of you may feel like walking out, but nobody has yet, so we'll try one more shot out of here. I'm going to shoot another cow. A lot of people don't agree with me on this, especially pastors, but you probably will. Every Christian is not a missionary, and every ministry is not missions. Now, I'm going to admit to you right up front, I think I've already lost this battle. This is one my last blast at it, and if churches simply insist that every ministry is missions, then we'll just have to come up with a new term, cross-cultural missions or international missions or some other way to define what we're doing. But a few years ago, I visited a pastor who asked me, he said, how do mission organizations prepare people to become missionaries? And I was thinking about crossing cultures and learning to work in other cultures and learning scripture and so forth. But it took me a little while to realize that what he said, I want to prepare all my people to be missionaries. I want to prepare all my people to be missionaries. So I'm trying to think, where do these people work that they're all going to be reaching out cross-culturally? But it took me a little while to figure out that what he was asking was, I want all of my people to be sold out for Christ's purposes. So he looked at missionary. A missionary is a person who's sold out for God. They're not materialistic. Their whole focus is on helping people to become Christians. And I want my people to be like that, so I want to prepare my people to become missionaries. Well, this has become very widespread, of course. I think you probably all heard these kinds of statements. We're all missionaries. When you go out that door, you're entering your mission field. You're either a missionary or a mission field, or you're a missionary to your world. Okay? Now, you know what the pastor is saying when he says this. You understand what he's saying. He's saying he wants you to be to live the Christ life and be a good witness and speak up for Jesus and be involved in outreach, and he wants you to do those things. You understand that. Those are very noble sentiments. Nobody disagrees with that. But you wonder why we couldn't just say you are all Christians. I mean, that's what a Christian is supposed to do, right? You're all Christians. Or if that's not good enough, you're all disciples. But our words tend to lose their meaning, so we go get other words. So now the word missionary has been stretched out. Well, traditionally, at least traditionally since I've been alive, which is less than 80 years, when someone, a missionary is a person sent on a mission. A person sent on a mission. And so they've sort of left the familiar things behind. They've taken specialized training as needed. They've maybe done some kind of an internship. They have learned to cross another culture, some kind of a barrier, and learned to live and understand those people and help those people and share the gospel. They've usually had a great deal of preparation, self-sacrifice, an unusual dependence upon God, those kinds of things. The preparation for a specialized ministry, and they're sent off to do that. I think a vocation like that deserves a term of its own to set it apart as somebody who's specially prepared and sent to do something or other. I like that. I understand that. But, you know, we don't do that anymore. Now, you say, well, what's the big deal? Well, you know, we have doctors. Doctors are people who go through a rigorous and expensive program of advanced training to become qualified. They have to do an internship. They have to do a lot of things to become a doctor, or a nurse does. And so the fact that you spent a week taking care of your sick aunt, or that you did a summer internship in a hospital, does not make you a doctor or a nurse. You know, not everybody that takes care of their aunt is a doctor. If they were, who would be? You know, you might have your appendix taken out by somebody who's never held a scalpel before. You know, there are consequences to ideas. So somebody who spends 2 weeks in another country does not just magically become a missionary. They may have been more of a hindrance than a help, for all we know. So I like to use the term missionary for something that's special. And then I've noticed that church missions budgets suffer from scope creep. You know what scope creep is? Everybody in business, I'm supposed to be done about a minute from now. Okay. I got another 20 minutes just based on precedent. Have you ever noticed how many things people try to get in your missions budget? Everything. Stuff you wouldn't believe gets in the missions budget. I had a missions pastor friend. He said, I call the missions budget the wastebasket. Because as every other staff member, whatever he doesn't want in his budget, he tries to get it in my budget. Well, what's the problem with that? You know, I approached a pastor just within the last few months. I said, you know, I don't feel like this church has given a whole lot to international missions. He said, well, when you put it together with our regional missions and our local missions and our benevolent fund, we're doing better than 10%. At least we were the last time I calculated it out. I said, well, how can you lump these together like that? And he said, well, it's a lot easier to cast vision for missions if it's just one, you know, big picture. And it didn't occur to me several weeks later that I should come back and said, Pastor, you know, I have a certain proportion of my money that I give to the church, but I've also been approached by the Fireman's Fund and two or three other funds, and I think I'm just going to lump it together as money that I don't spend on myself. You know, and after all, it's whole life stewardship. Why should I have a separate category for giving at all? You know, it's all His, and I'm all life for His. My pastor probably wouldn't go for that too big. So the reason that you have a category or a budget for something is because if you don't have it there and keep rein on yourself, you won't naturally do it. It'll end up somewhere else. And I'm afraid that's what's happening with our missions budget. It's all ending up a lot of somewhere else. Let's suppose, for example, I have two boys. So let's take my oldest boy. Let's say I was giving him $20 a month allowance. Well, his younger brother's growing up. So I go to my older boy one day and I say, look, I've been giving you $20 a month allowance and your brother's getting a little older. He should have an allowance, don't you think? Oh, yeah, Dad. Well, I'm thinking about giving him maybe $10 a month allowance. Well, that's great, Dad. Well, I'm going to take it out of your allowance, son. You know, it's true. We've been ignoring our communities for years. And we ought to do something. But that doesn't mean we ought to stop doing things in the area of the world that have the least Christians, the fewest churches, the least Christian resources, and pull that back and spend it here. Here's what I suggest. Deploy your people locally and send your funds globally. Now, you can't do that 100%, but we can do it a whole lot more than we are. You know, if you took the money that you were going to pay the boy to mow the widow's yard across the town, and you spent it to hire that boy to mow your own yard, you might not have money to mow the widow's yard. But if you mow your own yard, you can pay somebody else to mow the widow's yard. So let's deploy our fixed assets where we are and our portable assets where we're not. Now, a lot of people justify this by saying the United States is the biggest mission field in the world, or one of the biggest mission fields in the world. Of course, there's a little caveat to that. This is the mission field where 30% of the people in the world are aligned with an evangelical movement. And evangelicals are people who believe it ought to share your faith, which means we're native evangelists. So here we've got a big unreached people group, and a third of the people are native evangelists. So, you know, how much more do we need? We've got to get our people deployed. So here's the problem again. The more people we call missionaries and the more things we call missions, the less progress we make at finishing the task. The less progress we make at finishing the task. So I want to conclude with this. God has a vision for His church. He has a vision for history. He has an end goal. I want you to close your eyes and I want you to see the goal in your mind when I read it to you from the book of Revelation. Just close your eyes. Here's God's vision from Apostle John. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." Can you see it in your mind? Can you see it in your mind? Keep your eyes on the goal. Let's do everything we can to help our church focus on the goal.